Joining us, it is Dr. Bob Zybak. He is a doctor of environmental sciences. He also has a PhD in historical ecology. He joins us on the wake-up call because he has just come out with a new paper looking at the footprint of the Archie Creek fire. And the paper itself is called A Growing Sea of Snags. And I'll let you kind of describe what you were looking for and how you got into that. But I guess I want to ask you first, how is it that you decided that you were going to go back and get your PhD after spending a number of years operating a successful reforestation business?
It was a pretty easy decision. When the spotted owl flew into town, the reforestation business wasn't so successful. So there was a lot of closures of mills and logging businesses and so on. And so it was a kind of a financial decision and also one of personal interest.
Okay. And since then, what have you done with that degree?
Mostly written articles, given lectures, done reports such as this one. There's not a large demand for a degree that contradicts a lot of the modeling that's driving a lot of our policies. So it's been a less lucrative and less steady than my reforestation career.
Okay. All right. So 2 years ago, we had the perfect firestorm, or if you will, the imperfect evil firestorm, but a firestorm it was, with a number of fires burning around the state, over 1 million acres scorched, of course, the Holiday Farm fire up along the McKenzie. But you specifically looked at the Archie Creek fire burning in Douglas, or that burned in Douglas County, scorched over 130,000 acres, and in particular, you were looking at tree snags, and we're talking about trees that had burned before, right?
Yep. I actually documented quite a few of the fires and wrote some articles about them and some editorials. Matt Hill of Douglas Timber Operators was particularly interested in the Archie Creek fire, and we discussed what would be most helpful in looking at the history of these fires. And as we were doing that, the 2021 fires blew up in the exact same area for the same reason, the presence of multiple snags, road closures, riparian buildups in buffers, and almost all on federal land. Just the last 20 or 30 years of fuel buildups with snags taking an increasing role in the severity of these fires and their spread.
Okay, when you say a snag, I think some people think of snag, they look up at a tree, they see a big limb that is hanging there that is already broken, maybe going to fall off. What is the exact definition of quote-unquote a snag in terms of what we're talking about?
A snag is a standing dead tree. When it falls down, it's a log. It can become a nurse log in the so-called natural environment, or can become furniture if it's harvested, but a standing dead tree. So when you have a fire that goes through tens of thousands of trees that are living, and it's a crown fire, within hours they all become snags. And then over time, the characteristics of how they burn and so on change.
So really what it turns out to be is just a perpendicular presto log. After a certain amount of time, it's dead and it's dried out. Is that a good way to describe it for the layman?
A presto log covered with pitch.
Oh.
These things are pitchy. When they're green, they're full of water. And so they discussions of how much biomass burns and so on, that ignores the difference between a green tree full of water and a snag, which is essentially standing air-dried firewood full of pitch, is significant.
So if a fire were to break out in the footprint, say 5-10 years later, like the Archie Creek fire, with those standing snags, those are just going to add more fuel to the fire, I guess is what you're saying then.
Yes, and a particular type of fuel. They burn a lot hotter. They can go, parts of limbs and things can go 2,000 feet in the air. They can travel because they're tall. When the tops are burning and the winds are created from the fire, they can start spot fires 1 and 2 miles in advance, whereas green trees typically can't do any of those things. So they're a much more volatile fuel. They catch fire much easier, and then they're a far more dangerous fuel for reasons I outline in the report.
Okay. As you look then at the footprint of the Archie Creek fire and all of these snags that are left there, like you said, typically on federal lands, my question would be, you know, is our policies set up almost in a way to create more problems than supposedly it's going to solve? And I realize that's kind of a political question, but I need to ask it anyway.
It's entirely politics, and yes, the answer is yes. Starting with the Endangered Species Act and Environmental Access to Justice Act, in which environmental organizations, and there's only 3 or 4 or 5 of them with a few dozen lawyers, could file suit to stop logging in deference to a salamander or a bird or a fish or whatever. They've done it hundreds of times now, so it's a well-known process. That has resulted in our federal lands in particular becoming choked with fuels along riparian areas, along ridge lines, contiguous growths of trees along the hillsides. And then as they die and fall to the ground, we have serious ground fuel. So the policies are political, of course, but they're resulting in Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Forest Service lands being passively managed, and then myself and several other people for the last 20 or 30 years said, you're just building up fuel loads and you're creating potentials for catastrophic wildfires, and that's exactly what has happened.
Now, as a historical ecologist, do you look back at history and man's interface with these particular forests? Can you look back to things like, say, the Tillamook burn and see cases like this, although I think they probably went in and salvaged a lot of that? But how far back can you go to look and say, yeah, you leave these snags here and the next fire is going to be even more intense?
Well, the Tillamook burn is a perfect example. Actually, there's a Cedar Mountain fire in 1918, but the 1933 fire was a blow-up similar to the whole string of fires, the unprecedented number of Labor Day fires in 2020, but it was a similar blow-up. One person was killed by a falling tree, a tree seized worker in a camp, I think it was a green tree, but several people were saved by going into an old Indian prairie, which a person had turned into a ranch. And the same thing happened with my own family in the Yakult fire, which is very similar, a series of repeated burns growing larger and more volatile because of the presence of snags. In the case of my family, it was Speleyi Prairie in 1902, where wild animals and local people gathered. I think there's still 30-some people killed. But these old Indian prairies were lifesavers for lots of people during these events.
When you call them Indian prairies, were they created by the natives living in the areas in those times or prior to that?
Yes, the whole Willamette Valley, Rogue River Valley, Umpqua Valley, ridgelines, riparian areas. People were gathering firewood daily for thousands of years. They were traveling the riparian and ridgeline areas, not always daily, but seasonally at least. Huckleberry fields, camas, meadows, grassland prairies, oak savanna were all created and maintained by people for many generations. And that relationship is the one that is typically overlooked, maybe lip service, but overlooked as far as actual analysis when it comes time to look for coho habitat or spotted owl habitats. Those people are using models that don't include even common sense in relationships between the people that lived here and the vegetation over the landscape.
All right. You talk about in the paper that you wrote regarding this, and by the way, joining us is Dr. Bob Zyback. You talk about this, and that is over the course of multiple fires rolling through these areas where the snags have been left, that eventually it becomes something else. And what I'm saying is that environment becomes something else. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, when you have a 100% kill of the trees, then usually there's a few left after a fire. When the snags are there and they burn again, they typically burn all of the all of the tree reproduction, the seed trees, and the living trees in an area, and so they typically convert to an entirely different vegetation pattern. For instance, in Southwest Oregon, in the Kalmiopsis area, they're just getting giant fields of brush after repeated fires have killed off the trees and their seedlings.
Just brush?
Yep. And a lot of the, if you look at a Silver Complex fire from, I think, 87 or 89, the Biscuit fire from 2002, the Chetco bar fire from 2017, there is a large developing brush field behind within those areas.
Which really doesn't do a whole lot for the environment.
No, and it creates the types of brush that are flammable. It creates a real problem for people trying to maintain trails. It creates a real problem for large animals we like say deer and elk that need feed. Birds don't have trees to nest in, and so on. So it creates an entirely different environment, one that's generally hostile to people and not particularly valuable to most wildlife.
What is the argument that is used, and how valid is it, and I kind of have an idea what you're going to say, but still, that, you know, I mean, you brought it up, these different environmental groups, and the Biscuit Fire is the one that comes to mind. It's like all of that timber that was burned but still salvageable that just left there. What is the reason for leaving it? I mean, what is the supposed science that says, no, you need to leave that because it's better if you do?
Well, I'm glad you said supposed science, because this process is giving science a really bad name. We've got people, instead of going into the field and taking notes or documenting we can use digital video now and so on, they're sitting in an office or a room with a computer, and they're doing modeling. And so the modeling is based on assumptions, which are rarely stated. And so it leads in a misdirection. Mm-hmm. And that misdirection results in laws, with people becoming really concerned. I think some of the people are concerned, and other people are there just for the ride, but very concerned that we're going to lose the marble murrelet population, or the coho populations are going to be restricted. And I think they're sincere, but it's also opportunistic organizations and politicians and their legal representatives that put thousands of loggers and tree planters out of work in exchange for a few dozen white-collar workers making a good living. That's kind of a sour viewpoint, but it's one that's been developed over decades.
Well, you talk about the riparian areas. I would think that if you have charred timber that is standing there, as it rains, and it does, as it rains, that part of that washes off and goes right into these riparian areas. I would think that would be actually poisonous, hazardous, or otherwise deleterious to whatever fish, whether we're talking salmon, steelhead, native cutthroat throat trout, or whatever, would actually make it more of a hazard for them and less likely to survive with all of that going into the water.
Well, I don't think it's so much the dead standing trees. Most of the riparian areas were open for thousands of years, because that's where people bathe and swim and gather water mm-hmm. and fish. So this idea would start about the 1980s that we had to have a bunch of brush covers. I think the greater problem, and Mike Newton and others did research on this in the 90s and were ignored because it didn't fit the model. But that heavy brush cover creates heavy shade, and that is really difficult for the fish cycle, because small animals that they're eating and the plants that those animals eat are shaded out. They need solar energy in order to exist and proliferate. So the heavy shade is a problem. And then the other problem is you've got all those fuels now building up the riparian areas. And the Biscuit Fire is a good example. You could go to areas, $7 Mountain, and you can see where the fire, where they left a riparian area from a logging operation, and the fire just went right up the riparian area like a chimney, just because all the fuel was there, and the topography is such that fire just travels really well and travels from side to side. The riparian areas usually be a buffer to a wildfire, just ready access of fuel, so it skips over the riparian area real easy, or even accelerates.
So you've laid out a number of things that you thought or believe, think, look at, and see need to be done after these big fires. Of course, the first is get rid of the snags. What are some of the other things that you think should be done to, you know, bring a healthy regeneration to these areas?
Well, I think there's a number of things that can be done. Those are in the recommendations, and they're mostly pointed at BLM and Forest Service, and quite mm-hmm. a few of those things they used to do before we had all the big fires. So keeping the roads and trails open and accessible, rather than doing road closures and creating roadless areas, artificial roadless areas, so that people have ready access to points of ignition and to reforestation processes and to monitoring and so on. So ready access to the areas is important. And then I think rethinking some of the patterns that are going in there. When we're planting trees every 8 or 10 or 12 feet, as my crews did for 20-some years, you're just creating a contiguous fuel across the landscape. And if you don't take care of the debris that's there beforehand, then you've got ground fuels, so a fire will get real hot and burn along the ground. So you're creating a potential fire hazard. We saw a lot of those burn up during the Labor Day fires. So opening up the ridge lines again, maintaining, reestablishing maybe some prairie, some savanna, opening up the riparian areas again as they were in past times, creates fire breaks, creates recreational opportunities. Aesthetically, I think dead trees are ugly. I guess some people think they're critical for black-back woodpeckers or some kind of ecological reason. But I don't know if they even believe that anymore with all the evidence of the past 20 years. I think they just realize that they've got a good thing going financially. Mm-hmm. And for the rest of us, we're having to deal with unemployment in rural areas and wildfire and smoke.
Do you think that, looking back 2 years ago, do you think that what happened was utterly predictable?
Yes, not on that scale, because the east winds blew across all the way from California to the Columbia River and beyond. So not on that scale, but individually, yes, those fires, May and others have openly predicted that this is going to occur when we have these areas that the Clinton plan created. A lot of them have just turned into firebombs. From 1952 until 1987, we had one large fire in western Oregon. The Oxbow Fire in 1966 is about 40,000 acres. It was the only one above 10,000 acres. Now we've got a 10,000-acre fire burning on Rum Creek. Labor Day fires, we had about 10 fires of that magnitude going at the same time. So these were predicted many years ago. It's happening on federal lands, and for the reasons that I've been giving, road closures, riparian buffers, not treating or salvaging snags, and all of which create taxpaying jobs that are useful to the local economies and are good for wildlife. I mean, we're killing millions of wildlife with these fires. They're not protecting any wildlife or creating critical habitat. They're massive killing events.
When I reported on this story that about, you know, the study that came out, I got a number of emails from folks that said, oh, that guy's nothing but, you know, some shill for the timber industries. He was a reforester. He's just got a, you know, he's just got a burr in his bonnet. When people say that, what, how do you respond to that?
I tell them I wish I was a shill for the timber industry, then I could get a steady paycheck. But no, what I'm doing is documenting everything. And the people that are upset and attacking me personally, mm-hmm. not attacking the ideas or not attacking the statements or not attacking the documentary evidence that I'm putting out, are showing their true colors. They're saying, okay, despite all this documentary evidence, despite the academic achievement, despite the 25 years of practical experience, the guy's just pissed off. Trust me, I know, and don't listen to him. I mean, that's what they're saying. It's pretty stupid.
Well, there you go.
In my opinion.
What? Okay, now that's fine. What are you working on next? I mean, are you going to continue, you know, observing, because it's a lab right here in our own backyard, the Archie Creek fire footprint, or do you have other things that you're going to be working on?
Well, that's interesting. The report in many ways is saying we need a collaborative study on these fires. It's a perfect time. It all of these different ownerships, all of these different river basins at the same time, under the same circumstances, how did the fire respond to different types of management actions? That is a critical piece of research that I really hope takes place and would very much like to assist on. Other than that, I've been working on the Elliott State Forest with Southwestern Oregon Community College students and Oregon websites on the Elliott. That turned out to be political. Initially, it was just doing the history of the Elliott and questioning some of the Endangered Species Act statements. Mm-hmm. And then I'm working on the history of Letitia Carson, a black pioneer that came on the Oregon Trail in 1845 and defeated a white man in court a couple times, and then homesteaded in Douglas County successfully and matriarch of the Umatilla tribes. So she's kind of a part of historical ecology, is studying about people in the environment. And mm-hmm. She just popped up a few years ago, and now it's they've named a school after her, and I've been doing some additional research on her life.
All right. Well, Bob, it was a pleasure talking to you. Definitely, we'll keep you in the Rolodex. Bob Zybak on the wake-up call, Dr. Bob Zybak. Thanks for talking about the study, and we'd love to have you back on in the future to talk about, you know, other things in regards to our forest policies and how we're doing things. Thank you again for sharing your expertise.
Thank you, Bill, and I look forward to talking again.